Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to Radio Islam International, lights right from our studios here in Durban, with the panel discussion hosted by our team here in Durban for the month of March. And as we know that South Africa in the midst of the Anti-Racism Week, and that coincides with a very important subject that should never ever leave the radar of our community, that our fight against racism, our fight against injustice and inequality, is in sync with every other community across the world that has got a similar challenge ahead of them, either currently or either in the future for that matter. And showing this very same parallel with our struggle is a struggle and an issue that can never ever leave the radar or the chapter of every righteous person, whether they are of Muslim background or not, and that is the Palestinian struggle. Our panel discussion this morning features on that struggle and the intent and the purpose, and there are many aspects of the struggle that we could highlight, and it will take us days upon days to open up every discussion point. But the main focus that I would like to highlight for this panel discussion, who by the way hosted by myself but my two guests in studio, Hafiz Sadiq Saeed of Peter Maritzburg, Richmond originally, but from that area. And Hafiz Saab, alhamdulillah, many of us are aware of his contributions with the...
Welcome back to Radio Islam International. Ma, for that brief interruption in our communication. Cloudy day out here in Durban indeed. I'm sure there's some storms and some fog on the way, so as a result, signal takes some time to deliver, but I trust it's coming loud and proud and clear this time. We were on that first discussion when we had lost a bit of network regarding the similarities between the Palestinian struggle and the apartheid, the old apartheid struggle. My panelists, of course, Hafiz Saeed, as I introduced him earlier on, and brother Mustafa Darsot, coordinator of SAMNET. By Mustafa, just coming back to you, we were on the discussion of Ahad Tamimi, and this is a very relevant issue, that somebody has come as a global activist for her people, and then a few weeks or months later, all of a sudden, her village is targeted, and she as an individual and family members are targeted. Is this, has this got the semblance of it being a coordinated attack, which we have seen systematically engaged upon activists of anti-Zionism?
Most definitely, Maulana. If you look at, again, our local situation with the way the security branch operated here in South Africa, the moment there was a voice somewhere in the community or within, whoever spoke out against apartheid, they, within a few days, they were targeted, arrested, incarcerated, etc. So, last year, with the roadshow, if you want to call it, of Ahad Tamimi and her family, her dad, Bassam Tamimi, and etc., they went around to highlight what is happening on a day-to-day reality, right, in their village. And because Ahad Tamimi, being this teenager, being the symbolic of showing this fist, clenching this fist towards an Israeli soldier, which made her, which the journalist who captured that image became a global icon, went around, having these roadshows to and etc. So, what happened was that I had a sneaking suspicion that she's going to go back home and something's going to happen, not necessarily to her itself, but to the family, because at the end of the day, whatever these activists do, they have been watched, they have been monitored. And I don't find it no strange timing, I'm not surprised by the timing. I don't find it strange timing that their house was raided in December and her cousin was shot brutally on the face, in fact disfigured badly, required surgery, and she was arrested. And under what charge? For slapping a soldier. I mean, at the end of the day, you give the child a slap on the wrist and say, listen, you'll be a good girl and, go back home. That would have been in a normal situation, or maybe do some community service. But this, Israel wanted to silence her. They have taken away an activist. So again, we see the parallels between what happened in apartheid South Africa and what's happening in apartheid Israel. And the modus operandi is the same. In fact, if only thing is that they've got the backing of the global powers, be it the US, right, which is especially now under Donald Trump, right, whereas South Africa had the backing of the UK, you know, or should I say the UK was silent towards South Africa's crimes when, as an apartheid state. However, after 1973, when the international convention was held, the global tide of opinion turned against South Africa, and pressure was on the international community to do something about it. And then you saw sanctions a few years down the line coming about, to the point whereby even the UK couldn't say anything. In fact, Margaret Thatcher, at the very in 1989 or 1988 at the Commonwealth meeting, that time in Kuala Lumpur, you know, where you had Kenneth Kaunda on one side, who said that the only way to cripple South Africa is through rigorous sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that, oh, we can't do that, you know, South Africa is coming right, you know. She was of this, you know, delusional, feeling that South Africa is coming right. And the pressure was stepped up until we saw that late 1989, the White Parliament had the elections, the flag came in, and announced soon after that the string of reforms, which they were under pressure. Was it because they had a change of heart, or because we said, hey, listen, we need to embrace our African brothers? No, because at the end of the day, they knew where South Africa was heading economically. It was in dire straits. The boycotts had a serious effect on the country and the sanctions, and they had to do something about it.
You know, one of the great pictures that always is painted in the minds of the international community, those that have shown solidarity with the Palestinian people, is not necessarily the religious agenda or the religious frame of mind that Muslims portray towards the Holy Land, or Jews or Christians, but rather the very everyday dire situation of the Palestinian people. And this is an important point to continue to highlight and continue to express, that the struggle of everyday life in Palestine. You know, Hafiz Saeed, looking from a PSF point of view, and of course from an activist point of view, Israel stands constantly accused of denying basic rights to the Palestinian people. And this is not, unlike many oppressive regimes of the world, but it seems that the Zionist oppression of the Palestinian people, when it comes to freedom of movement, when it comes to basic medical attention, when it comes to even education, and the free movement of academic flow between various departments or internationally with the Palestinian people, which is the right of the day, technological access, all of these here are highly denied and highly suppressed, you know, by the state. Describe life in Palestine. What are those basic human needs and necessities that are suppressed by the state?
Maulana, you know, as you know, they say that Israel is built on Jewish privileges and also on the destruction of the Palestinian rights. For example, the olives. You take the olive trees, which is very, very dear to the Palestinian people. Here we're not talking about Masjid al-Aqsa, we're not talking about the religious side. We're just talking about their land, which they have been cultivating for many, many, many years. And now all of a sudden, you know, anybody that travels to Israel, I mean, or to Palestine, and if he's a conscious South African who knows the difference between right and wrong, you'll be able to see that how the Palestinians love their land, how the Palestinians love their olive trees. But yet there is evidence that daily the trees are uprooted. Now, why would somebody go and uproot trees? For example, people are talking about global warming, climate change. And here you have a country that goes and uproot trees, which belongs to the Palestinians, and it's their livelihood. Likewise, similarly, you take education. Education is one of the basic human rights for everybody. But a Palestinian child, when they're going to school, they have to pass checkpoints, they have to pass soldiers. Now, what goes through that little child's mind that every morning I'm going to school? And education is a basic right. Similarly, you talk about the water. You know, water is something also a basic human need and a human right. and you find that the Palestinians are denied these things. Yet the settlers can fill up the swimming pools and fill up the other things and have the water sports and everything. And here you find like Gaza. In Gaza they've got a huge water crisis, a huge water problem. And the whole world knows about it, that water is needed for human survival, is needed for many other things. So these are some of the basic things that which are denied to the Palestinians. Then you take the medical issues. There is recorded evidence that where women have given birth at checkpoints, women have given birth outside their homes while waiting for ambulances to come. Then you take a world icon. Like you take, for example, Nelson Mandela. Why would Nelson Mandela make a statement to say that South Africa cannot be free if Palestine is not free? Surely he must have seen something. Then you take another famous American president, Jimmy Carter. In his book, he's very clearly has written that a Palestine peace, not apartheid. So why did he also link our peace with apartheid? And as Muslims we know there cannot be any truth and justice without fairness, without the right to live, all these things. So here we're not only talking about religious rights, we are also talking about basic human necessities and basic human rights.
And Brother Mustafa, you know, posing that question to you, you've been involved, alhamdulillah, as an activist in the struggle for many years now, and you have interacted with many visiting Palestinian academics, scholars who have come, those who have based themselves in the occupied part of the region, as well as those who are in the post-67 period of, you know, of the West Bank or Gaza. What stories, you know, do these people relate? And, you know, probably on an average 3 or 4 months, somebody's coming along and your interaction with them, you know, is there, be it over dinner, be it formal or informal. But surely these stories of the suppression of basic everyday human rights are common. What's your experience in that regard, by Mustafa?
Well, it's, I mean, hearing the, you know, hearing what they have to say to you, it's number one, it's heartbreaking, and it's a scary reality. Definitely not. It's no fantasy. It's no illusion. It's no fairy tale what they're relating, because this is now, you know, if you see, thanks to, you know, the emergence of social media over the past few years, whereas before we only had our sources through mainstream media, and the internet has allowed this opportunity to come about, and you know, people are getting people are seeing the reality through the eyes of those who go on the ground there and relate the stories back to their audiences. The reality is that it's from what they tell us, is it's hard. It's a worry. It's a struggle. It's a continuous struggle. It gets more and more difficult. More and more challenges are posed to them. Obstacles are there in the way, but at the end of the day, the people are not giving up, and that's what you have to admire, the resilience. You know, people do not give up, and at the same time, you know, people have this conception in their mind that, oh, you know, why is it only the Palestinian struggle? What about you know, situations elsewhere, like Kashmir, or, you know, take that for example. The thing is that what you have to look at is, you have to look at the root cause here. Here you've got a racist institution of Zionism, right, which is backed by your global powers financially to basically say, listen, we are there, we will do what we want to, and nobody can stop us, right? Then you've got a situation whereby India, you know, and incidentally, I was just there in January on holiday at the time when Netanyahu was there, you know, in Bombay, on top of it, of all places. And then you've got India, which is a country which, okay, was divided through partition, okay, which is a secular government right now with a Hindu nationalist ruling party, the BJP, and you've got the situation of Kashmir. But it's not only under the BJP. Kashmir has been a problem from the time of independence of the Indo-Pak subcontinent, where, you know, the British decided to give Kashmir to India instead of giving it its own determination, or Pakistan also wanted Kashmir. Anyway, to go into the Kashmir, we're going to sidetrack a lot. But coming to it, that here you've got, again, where did the roots of this come from? it's the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement was the one that pushed the British to, you know, give the land of Palestine, which was under there as a colony, to them. And at the same time, those same forces that were within the British government also decided, hey, we'll do the same here with Kashmir.
Mm.
Right? So you have to look at this inherent racist factor. At the same time, it's also the divide, you know, policy.
Mm.
You know, if we couldn't have it our way, then we're not going to let you enjoy it.
Mm.
You know, yes, we'll give you independence, we'll leave your territories, but we're not going to let you enjoy it. Mm. So we leave you more and more divided. And that, I would say, is the root cause here.
Indeed.
So coming to the visitors who come down, you interact with them and you find that this is the challenges that they have been faced with, and all they want is they want support and recognition. You need to keep up the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to be more active. You need to speak out. And the BDS is one way of doing this, by mm-hmm. boycotting. And you see, for example, you can have a list of 100 products to boycott.
Mm.
Let's be realistic, nobody's going to boycott all those products. Mm. It's impossible.
Mm.
However, with BDS, you've got it's structured, it's been researched, you've got a few things to start off with. You start off with that, you do it slowly, but the pressure is there.
Mm.
Right? So much so that now that people who are embracing BDS, were like a few years ago, were not in favor for it.
Mm.
So that even the Palestinian Authority,
mm.
which never supported and endorsed BDS, is now realizing, hey, wait a minute,
mm.
we need to work with BDS. Or we need to, you know, at least allow BDS to lead the way.
Mm.
And so at the end of the day, that's how it has to be, that we need to appreciate what these people are telling us. Number one, make sugar that we're not in that situation anymore. Mm. We were in that situation, yes, because we can understand it as South Africans.
Mm.
But take the non-South African. Nobody wants to be in that situation.
Mm.
Nobody wants to go, when you go to work, you have to go through turnstiles and looking at soldiers with guns, whether you want to go to school, etc. If you having a heart attack, you can die at a checkpoint. Nobody wants to go through those horrors.
Mm. You know, I had Dr. Hatim Bazian as my guest on Friday evening, just before Maghrib Salam. He's the BDS coordinator for the United States. And part of that discussion that we had earlier on, before I had him on radio, I think I need to get him on, you know, for that more extensively, was where he had a conversation with me regarding the network that the Palestinians had developed over the years to get their stories out. Now, he came to the U.S. from Palestine. He's born in Nablus, but he came in the 60s, and his father was a professor as well. And, well, of course, that time there was no form of BDS, but as far as Palestinian academics was concerned, he was one of the first in the U.S. And he was explaining how, you know, they developed this system in an age wherein there was no social media, there was no internet, there was practically zero electronic communication. Even to make a phone call, you had to phone an operator. He'll give you a time to call that person, how we used to phone Makkah and, you know, a person gone for Hajj back in the day. It was a long drawn non-WhatsApp type of a process. And he mentioned through the network of writings, poetry, road shows, and all those events in their most elementary stages, which brought us up today to the movement where it is currently. And those who started the movement, and whether they belong simultaneously to other organizations, they're long gone. But the fruits of their efforts continue to be harvested today. That leads me into the next question that I wanted to ask you, you know, Hafiz Saab. What network have the Palestinians developed? We know that South Africa, the struggle icons, they developed a network as well, whether it was writing Mandela's letters that were smuggled out of prison, whether it was the freedom writers, you know, Cry My Beloved Country, etc., that spoke about the ills taking place in South Africa via the pen. There was various network and a coordination of activities that took place, which today sounds very elementary, very rudimentary, but ultimately served as a foundation for the struggle today. Talk to us about some of those internal and external networks that the Palestinians have developed, Hafizah.
You see, Mulana, let's just take, if we start off a little bit from your earlier question.
Mm-hmm.
Like a few years ago, Mustafa, you recall, we had a guest here, Ramzi Baroud.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Ramzi Baroud, Samuel had invited him to South Africa. and he had come here to launch his book. My father was a freedom fighter. And one of the things I remember he mentioned in one of his talks, and he said his father died of asthma. And it was very, very painful to him, because in this century, asthma is no more a disease that you dread. Because there are medication that can treat asthma. There are medication that can control asthma very, very well, and people can live normal lives. But yet he says that his father died from a simple asthma attack. And he's one of the bloggers that I suggest to Radio Islam listeners that they should follow. Now, people like him, who unfortunately had to leave the homeland and go and live in America, and there he became a world-class journalist, and he became a world-class, even a, what you call an editor, and he even lectures in media and communication. So you admire people like this, coming from background, coming from an occupational background, coming from nothing, and they really built themselves up. I remember at that time when he came to South Africa, he was the chief editor of the Brunei Times, and he had come from Brunei to South Africa. Then, fast tracking after that, I remember meeting another author, Dr. Abu Ilesh. The University of Free State in Bloemfontein had invited him. And he also has written a very, very nice, interesting book, I Shall Not Hate. And Dr. Abu Ilesh was a super specialist when it comes to gynecology and infertility. And he also related a story, and he says that many a times in the morning when he was going to work, and he was working on the Israeli side, in those hospitals, and he was delivering Israeli babies, and he was attending to their problems. But when he comes to the border, sometimes the same Israeli female soldiers will block him and not allow him either way, either to go to work or either go home from work. They'll ask him their own personal medical questions, which he will answer, and he'll go back whichever way the soldiers send him, either back to the workplace or either back home and not go to work. Now, he also travels the world giving his stories, and people are becoming very, very receptive. Now, imagine now in a university background, he gave a talk, and I'm open to correction, and I think he is some high profile linked to the University of the Free State. So with these small activities that these people are doing, they are creating links worldwide, and obviously now with Twitter and Facebook and all that, so that support base is increasing.
Just to add to that, you see, definitely the diaspora of the refugees which are around the world, you know, the Palestinian diaspora, you know, as they have got educated and coming into the real world, they made sure that they let the world know where they're coming from, and you know. And this is what the cause is about. So, you see, the thing is, when we had apartheid South Africa, we didn't have many exiles around except for the few of the people in the underground movement of the ANC and the SACP that, you know, that were there, our struggle heroes. But here you've got a huge diaspora of a few million people. And yes, they have made a concerted effort to highlight their cause.
And indeed, of course, other efforts as well, through the bringing down of current Palestinian activist children, as in the case of Ahad Tamimi, you had mentioned earlier on, with the siblings and friends that highlighted the cause in that particular way. You know, moving on to creating awareness of the Palestinian struggle, and by Mustafa, I'm going to start with you on this particular question. Local organizations, and when I say local, not necessarily South African, but from a country other than Palestine, be it the UK, be it the US, how has this type of movement gained traction in the sense of the activities that they continue to plan, the outreach, the awareness that local chapters, be it of BDS or be it of other cultural or religious significance that they wish to attach to the cause, but talk to us of some of the efforts that are taking place locally here in South Africa, and maybe some to your knowledge abroad as well.
We'll come to the South African scenario just now, but look abroad. Take for example Europe and the UK and the US. The local organizations that have now embraced the cause and have decided to highlight and work with the cause, they are not only facing they are not only dealing with the problem of countering the Zionist lobby, you know, which is a big problem, especially in the US and the UK. But they've also got the growing emergence of nationalism and white supremacy and the neocon right wing, which is a serious problem, right? So here you've got now local organizations in this country would have to deal with these guys who are, you know, trying to, you know, steal the limelight and trying to make it seem that all the woes and the problems in the country is because we have immigrants, for example, right? So you've got that. Now, if you highlight the Palestinian cause, right, you are basically perceived to be supporting immigrants, right? The mindset is there. So with all the challenges, you know, the thing is that the local organizations are being resilient and they are fighting on multiple fronts, right? So they, and then at the end of the day, again, the exposure to the access of information makes a big difference compared to, say, 20 years ago or 25 years ago. So therefore, you'll find that with all these challenges, no matter how much the right wing, and look, it is hurtful, especially when you hear of, like, even when Donald Trump makes a statement and he's the president of the United States, when George Bush was around, you thought you had the worst or you heard the worst, not until he came on the scene, right? It does hurt, but at the same time, people are being resilient. They are taking the causes forward. Communities are waking up and saying, wait a minute, everybody's saying Muslims are bad or Palestinians are bad, but are they so bad, you know? And that comes to maybe self-introspection, etc., whereby people then say, wait, let's highlight this, let's support this. So from that point of view, in every country, if you take in Europe, Ireland is one of the leading supporters of the cause, right? Then you've got some of the Scandinavian countries that are leading the way, especially Norway, right? So you've got these countries that are there whereby the local organizations are doing their bit to work with whoever the leading figures are. And then on the South African scene, we have, you know, the NC4P, which is the National Coalition for Palestine, which is a grouping of all the Palestine Solidarity groups. The leading organizations in the country is the PSA, Palestine Solidarity Association. Then, of course, you've got the KZN chapter, which is KZN PSF, Palestine Solidarity Front. So you've got the local groups that are there to, you know, rally support. And then, again, working cross-section with unions, trade unions, political parties. We've seen now that the ANC at the December elective conference took a very hard line or a strong position against Israel, which is now it's left to be seen what unfolds and how it's been implemented, right? But it's got the Israeli lobby nervous about it.
But Mustafa, you know, inshallah, we, as always, you know, a little short on time as usual, but a spirited discussion indeed. I'm going for a short break, inshallah, for a couple of minutes, and when I return, I'm going to ask both our panelists to give us a minute or two of their closing remarks and statements on the movement, especially here in South Africa, as well as whatever thoughts they might like to share with our listeners. We'll be back in a minute.
That's right. You're on with the panel discussion with myself, Mona Janek, concerning, of course, my panelist Hafiz Sadiq Saeed out of Pietermaritzburg. He's with us here in the studio live, and Mustafa Darsot, director of SAMNET. Now, I have a minute or two left for both of you gentlemen, and an important question that has continued to come up and, you know, highlighted news-related or media-related headlines over and over again. Israel has, for the last few years especially, the last decade, spent millions on creating a positive image of itself as a tourist destination, inviting political leaders, presidents from all over the world, giving them a good time and showing them the positive side of the country. Have our organizations, in their limited resource capacity, did their bit, are they doing their bit currently to counter those efforts by the well-oiled, well-funded Zionist propaganda machine, at least from a local level, highlighting to our local politicians what's the real plight of the Palestinian struggle? Hafiz, I'm going to start with you, inshallah.
You see, Maulana, as we know, South Africans, and during the course of the discussion, Mustafa also highlighted it, South Africans have come from an apartheid background. We've come from a boycott background. We've come from many, many struggle backgrounds. And all this has inspired South Africans. And we know that Islam is based on truth and justice. And the Palestinian cause, besides it being a religious issue, it's also a moral issue. because we highlighted the human needs that are denied to the Palestinians. So all these things they have put together has inspired even children to become activists for the Palestinian struggle. Mm-hmm. So whether it's the BDS or whether it's PSF or whether it's PSA or whatever it is, in a small way, I think they are doing some very, very remarkable job and a remarkable task. If you look at it, see, for example, a few years ago, there was that issue with veggies.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall in Durban, we had a protest outside veggie stores.
Mm-hmm.
And a small thing like that brought registers to its knees.
Mm.
So like that, if you look at academic boycotts are happening, many universities are joining academic boycotts, then even some municipalities who were trying to go across and join Israel for certain work together,
mm-hmm.
were also stopped. So in our small way, although it's not funded like the Israeli lobby,
mm.
but we are achieving some very, very good progress is being made against the Israeli lobby and to show the Palestinian cause. So therefore, we should not be demoralized and feel upset that things are not really happening. Things are happening, and together with that, we got the weapon of dua, we got the weapon of tahajjud, we got the weapon of Islam, and inshallah, we hope maybe in our own lifetime too, Palestine will be free, inshallah.
Ameen, inshallah. By Mustafa, your closing comments on that.
Indeed, Maulana, you see, the thing is that when you mention that, people will say, but you know, Israel spends $1 billion a year on its PR campaign, and you know, how can we come to that? It's not a matter of that. Where every little bit you can do, or that small bit you can do, can make a difference.
Mm.
Already, I know of several people that, you know, have taken the effort and sent, whether it's have recommended to a politician or to a journalist to visit and see for themselves what's going on, and have done so, and they've come back with a total, you know, realize, hey, but I had no idea that this was happening,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know, already that, again, they'll pass the word around
mm-hmm.
to their friends, so the curiosity will be there.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, we must not despair. We must not give up. We must continue and highlight the cause. The more you highlight the cause, as I said, everybody does the little bit will make that difference.
Jazakumullah khairan, Hafiz Sadiq Saeed and by Mustafa Dansar for joining us. Now, before I conclude, important Aqsa 101 program taking place here, hosted by Hafiz Ibrahim Musa, our very own Hafiz Ibrahim Musa of Radio Islam International, who I have online. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Hafiz Ibrahim Musa.
Walaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know you are noted for your documentaries and you're noted for your long stories in general, but I'm going to give you 1 minute. I'm going to give you 1 minute to speak on Aqsa 101 taking place on the 22nd, I believe, here in Durban.
Yes, Maulana, this is an initiative of the Palestine Information Network, and we have developed these causes particularly for certain very influential groups. So one would be the women, because of the outreach that they have, another for journalists, and another for ulama. And the idea is that Aqsa is certainly the gateway to Palestine for many Muslims. So we're starting off with these particular causes, and obviously then would venture into deeper educational programs on other aspects of Palestine. So telling the story of Masjid al-Aqsa, its Islamic significance, telling the story of Masjid al-Aqsa in terms of its place in the Islamic theology, the threats facing Masjid al-Aqsa, but through telling that story we also then branch off into the geography about Palestine, history about Palestine, the plight of the Jerusalemites themselves, and what one can do to assist Masjid al-Aqsa. These causes have been developed with the assistance of researchers on the ground in Palestine, and we've also used a lot of first-hand material from Palestinians who are in the forefront of defending Masjid al-Aqsa, as well as we refer directly to the material of the influential temple movement in Israel. So a lot of material that people are not usually of faith with. So inshallah, we've done it in many other parts of the country. Coming to Durban this Thursday, for women at the Mariam B. Sultan Center, which is going to be from 9 to 11. And anybody who's 9 to 12, anybody who's interested, could contact the partners at the Caring Women's Network, or could email us info@palestineinfo.org.
Hafiz Ibrahim Musa, Jazakallah Khairan. I think a fitting end to our discussion here this morning, an important awareness campaign coming here to Durban on the Palestinian issue, and for that, alhamdulillah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you. Just gone 12 on the money, as they say, and time for us to conclude from our studios here in Durban. We trust, inshallah, this panel discussion was a source of benefit for you this Sunday morning. Many more coming through our Durban studios in the next few months. Stay tuned. But for now, from myself, Maulana Junaid Kersani, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.